You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello there. Hello there, Harold Pollack. This is Glenn Lowry at the Glenn Show, BloggingHeads.tv. Thank you for being willing to talk to me. This is, on the other end, Harold Pollack, the Helen Ross Professor in the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago, and my old friend. Hey there, Harold.
Hey, great to see you. And congratulations, by the way, on your recent wedding. I can say that you and I have both married above ourselves.
And, thank you very much. That's a compliment to my wife. This is LaJuan Lowry, whom Harold Pollack was so kind to photograph at, amongst others. We have professional photographer. Of course, Harold is semi-professional himself. At our wedding, which took place on October 7th in Houston, Texas, and Harold was there for the celebration. Thanks for doing that, Harold. And thank you very much, Harold, for the photograph, this beautiful print that you have gifted us with of us in the joyous expression of our love one for the other at our wedding. Harold, it's going to be on my mantle until the last breath.
Well, I'm glad. it was a wonderful moment.
Thank you.
So let's get to it.
Okay, so what are we talking about today? Harold, I mean, the audience should know, is an old friend of Glenn Lowry, the Glenn Show, and is also an antagonist. He and I are somehow differently predisposed on the political spectrum, him left and me right. I hate saying that, but I think it actually is true about our interactions.
I prefer to think of myself as a boring technocratic liberal. That's where most people would position me on the spectrum.
Then those people don't know you. They don't know your passion, Harold.
That's right. No, still waters run deep.
We were going to talk about an event here at Brown University that took place recently. Jean Tirole, the French economist, 2014 Nobel Prize winner in economic science, a professor at the School of Economics in Toulouse in the south of France, and also a perennial visitor at MIT, where he was a longtime faculty member and whatnot, came here to Brown University and was to have given a lecture, but instead preferred, he said, to be in conversation with someone about his book that has just been published by Princeton University Press called Economics for the Common Good. We will say more about that. I was his interlocutor. He and I sat on stage and engaged in conversation, and I hosted a reception for him here at my home. My wife and I did do, which was very lovely, we think relates in some ways because of the scientific contributions that Tirole has made, about which more, to the second topic on our agenda, which is the reputations of groups and how they can be besmirched and how group members feel about the collective view of themselves by others on the outside and how they feel about their own group members whose actions might besmirch the group's reputation and whether guilt and pride in one's group is a rational thing, et cetera, et cetera. A very interesting topic. Topic made all the more interesting by one Harvey Weinstein, who happens to be Jewish. I don't think one can avoid seeing that, and who also happens to have prominently displayed himself as to not be such a wholesome individual. And that, of course, relates to the larger question about sexual harassment, sexual abuse and assault, and the reputations of men who have undertaken those actions, which are now very much in play given all the things that have happened. We're going to talk about that. Then we're going to talk about politics and about how it is that one builds a winning coalition and about the trade-off that one inevitably faces between deepening the commitments of one's base, as it were, on the one hand, and reaching out into the margins of the undecided and the people who are on the fence. The intensive margin and the extensive margin of concept from economics that has broader application. That's our agenda, Harold.
It's a good agenda.
I think I've said quite a bit about Tirole. The new book from Princeton is called Economics for the Common Good. And Tirole, whose Nobel Prize is explained by the committee at great length in the notice that they have at their website, 40 single-space pages of description of the contributions that Tirole has made across a half-dozen fields of economics, microeconomics, theoretical and rigorous, mathematically, very beautifully and deeply rendered but also inevitably of great relevance on questions of the design of contracts, on the organization of firms, the regulation of industry and of monopoly, on questions of asymmetric information, applying game theory ideas to the analysis of a variety of practically important economic venues, of also important contributions in finance, of a CV that goes on for scores of pages of profound articles that Thoreau has published. So he's a technician, a deep scientist, but has since winning the Nobel Prize found himself a public intellectual. People walking up to him on the streets in Toulouse or in Paris and saying, what do we do about global climate change? And how do we deal with the problems of technological innovation and the displacement of work for people? What's the future of work? He's been asked to opine on all manner of the euro and can it be made to work, and the banking regulations and the European Union, the European Central Bank's policies, et cetera, et cetera. And in response to this barrage of, Thoreau's photograph was displayed on large posters around the Sea of Toulouse after winning the Nobel Prize. He speaks at high schools, Harold. You'd love him. This tall, elegant French gentleman who is modest to a fault and graceful and generous and self-effacing. You'd love him. He goes to high schools. He says people have greeted him on the street, congratulating him with tears in their eyes. Okay, talk about group pride. You know, the French people, and certainly the French people in Toulouse, are very proud of their Jean. So he was here. He was here, and he was in my home, our home. Luan and I received, I don't know, 25 guests or so for a reception for him after the event. I sat on stage with him, and basically we just batted it about, you know. Yeah. Why do people hate economics? Okay, the dismal science. Why is neoliberal an epithet? You know? Mm-hmm. And things like that. And indeed, does the 21st century leave us in a situation of knowing that socialism doesn't work? Okay, that markets, properly regulated, properly socialized, and politically grounded, are the future. They're really the only path if you want to be prosperous and if you want to be free. He's not an ideologue. I don't want anybody to get the wrong idea. He's an economist. Anyway, I talk too much, Harold. What do you think?
No, I think that it's your description of him reminds me of the person that you meet freshman year in college who is like super smart and successful, and you know, all the girls have crushes on him and you want to hate him, but he comes to your room and helps you set up your Wi-Fi without asking, so you like can't even do that. I think one of the things when I think about Thoreau's work, some of which I learned from you actually when I was a graduate student, what is two aspects. One is the world where markets are fundamentally changing. Some of the game theoretic constructs that he has, when you think about Facebook and you think about Uber and you think about the complex network markets that don't really look like hot dog vendors along the beach sort of the standard examples we use, having that apparatus to think about more complex network externalities, different kinds of barriers to entry that relate to information,
right,
that having that disciplined framework becomes essential because whether markets are the future or not, markets are an incredibly complex thing. And certainly I do a lot of healthcare work, and healthcare markets are inherently, they just don't look like the market for toothpaste. And you need to be able to think about adverse selection and right, all of the issues how do insurers try to attract the healthiest customers,
right,
given a regulatory structure. You know, there is no, one thing where you said, is socialism the future? I take it that you meant that as an assertion that should be discussed, are markets the future? That's an assertion to be discussed, not necessarily a conclusion we can draw. Real world markets are very inherently mixed and complicated and regulated and are riddled with market failures or deviations from the assumptions that we use. And so he's he's engaging that. That's probably him now asking me how to do that.
nice move, Harold. Can I say something? I do want to give you more time because I talked for a long time, but I don't want to lose this thought because you're making a really, really important point. To me, in my mind, I see this as a very important point. So you are an applied public policy analyst and scientist, and are confronted in the healthcare and social service delivery area with an array of challenges, intellectual challenges. And you were just speaking with some insight, I think, about how the kind of economics that Jean Tirole was awarded the Nobel Prize for doing is useful. And I want to make a more general point, and that point is about the development of economic science through the 20th century, and it has to do with the transition from the classical, I'm going to call it the classical Harold de Broglie, you know, you can throw in von Neumann and other people, but this kind of like setting up the general equilibrium, fixed point theorem, efficiency, use of convexity, the kind of elegant rendering of the perfect market, of the kind of ideal. So it's like the ideal theory, okay? It's the ideal theory where there are markets at every day for every contingency, and people are facing prices, and all those markets are not thin, but they're thick, and people are behaving competitively, and you know, separation of hyperplanes, and it's beautiful. It's a beautiful theory. Okay. However, on the basis of that theory have been built ideological edifices. Okay. Yeah. We know that the market is the ideal, you know, arrangement. Okay. But in fact, information is not perfect. In fact, trade is not idealized in this way. In fact, there are thin markets, and there is market power, and there is strategic behavior. And there is an inability to make commitment, and enforcement is not something that just comes automatically through the ether. It's something that has to actually be rendered by imperfectly informed and differentially interested parties who we call our government.
Absolutely.
So in that space, see, there hadn't been, this is the point that Tirole would make, there had not been the toolkit to analyze those situations, okay? In 1950, that toolkit did not exist, okay?
Yeah.
By the time you get to 1970, 1980, that toolkit is coming into existence. The whole study of industrial organization is being revolutionized by game theory. The whole study of markets like insurance markets and so forth is being revolutionized by the economics of incomplete information. And there's a slew of Nobel Prizes out there with people named Akerlof and Stiglitz and Spence
Maskin
and Meyerson and Horowitz and people of this kind. That are, and more recently, Hart and Holmstrom and Tirole, that are a tribute to the profound significance of the revolution in technique within microeconomic theory. See, people, I mean, I'm sorry, I'm going to go against some people on the left because they dismiss what they call neoliberal economics with the back of their hand, and they think it's necessarily rooted in some kind of political vision. This is a science, okay? And there are insights that are being advanced as this science, and to dismiss that whole enterprise, you know, that's the economics department. I don't want to go anywhere near that. You know, it kind of annoys me. Anyway, I now begin.
By
to,
the way, I there's no question that the leaders in economic theory are doing is what you've just described, and a lot of and certainly the critique of economics that the sort of economics 101 simplified model isn't very applicable. No kidding, you know, that's not an interesting critique of economics. There are certainly other disciplines and other critiques that can be made that are more interesting and valuable. But I agree that there is a simplistic dismissal of economics that is just not interesting because it's not described. It doesn't actually engage what people like Tirole, who are the leading economists in the world, are actually doing. I do wish that the Nobel Prize were broadened to all of social science because Clifford Geertz, for example, would have a lot to say about all the things that you just mentioned. And it's not healthy that economics is so hegemonic in some ways. I do think that it is not a great thing that when you talk to really smart economists, they have no idea who many of the leading anthropologists, sociologists, political scientists are not engaging with that. And, so I think that there's certainly critiques that can be made.
Well, I think you can explain it. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off. I just want to emphasize, I think your point is very well taken that the other social sciences are of profound significance, especially for a person doing applied things, the kind that you're interested in. I was just going to observe that I think economics is privileged because just in the kind of sociology of scientific prize giving, the hard sciences are in the driver's seat. Okay, that's where you start, and then in order to expand, they have to agree. So economics has mathematics, and they can see where that's quote rigorous close quote much more easily than they might be able to appreciate the depth and significance of the knowledge in other fields. So economics gets included. The same debate went on at the National Academy of Sciences, you know, before they started giving membership in the National Academy to mere sociologists. You know, that was, and in fact, I think Samuel Huntington's case at the National Academy of Science, if I remember this correctly, and I surely hope I do, he's the great political scientist at Harvard who wrote important books. I could name them if I knew what they were. But he was definitely a towering figure in political science and the study of government. And his membership was controversial, as I recall, whenever it happened, you know, 40 years ago or whenever it happened, because the people didn't know whether or not that was really science. So in any case, that was item number one on our agenda. We thought that it naturally led into a discussion of the case of one Harvey Weinstein and of one Harold Pollack's feelings about his humiliation, and then of the larger issues that were raised about that, about being a member of a group's reputation, a person's sense of shame or pride in the things that other members of the group do, and so on, what we're calling reputational, collective reputation, reputational externalities, this kind of idea. So you want to say something about that?
Yeah, I felt on a couple of levels, a real sense of shame and reputational damage by the revelations. In fact, about Harvey Weinstein, and we could add Anthony Weiner and Leon Wieseltier. You know, I'm followed by a lot of people on Twitter, and this guy tweets at me, and he happens to put in the same tweet. He's got he says, "What's going on? Liberals in Hollywood are really," and he lists all of these Jewish people. Many of whom, by the way, had names that began with W, and some of them were not in Hollywood, actually, like Anthony Weiner. And I do feel I'm ashamed in a way. I mean, of course, none of these people, you know, this has no relationship to my own life and to anything about my, you know, I'm not a Hollywood mogul. I am not, none of these behaviors reflect on me personally. But they do. I do feel like I have some responsibility for this person in a way that, both in terms of, I feel a sense of guilt that it makes no sense, but also I feel like it affects the reputation of, here are these prominent liberal Jewish guys, some of whom are intellectuals, who are behaving in a disgusting way, and it reflects on me. And there's a reputational externality there that is a kind of a real thing. I don't know if you've had similar experiences, but it's kind of a punch in the gut in a certain way. That's not entirely logical, but in some ways is very logical.
We could discuss the logic of it. I would not say offhand it's without its logic, although I'd want to, like you were saying earlier, explore it carefully, you know, with a fully specified model, if you will, to get sure we don't miss subtle effects. Mm-hmm. But I want to say something else. Of course this has happened to me. What, have you ever heard of something called black crime?
Okay. I've heard.
Have you heard about the murder rate in Chicago and et cetera, et cetera? And unfortunately, the fig leaf that people tried out, oh, if they call attention to that, they're racist. Read anti-Semite. Unfortunately, that fig leaf that they tried out, that trump card they think they can play, doesn't cover enough.
Yeah.
Okay? Let's just be real for a minute. It doesn't cover enough. You think people have forgotten that all these guys are Jewish? You can drive the thought underground, but you can't prevent people from noticing that. They're going to notice that, and what they make of it, you know, is something that we could discuss. And likewise about so-called black crime. So yes, of course, when the pathological behavior of some members of my guild, my group, my clan are made public, I am impacted by that. And I wanted to try something on you, though, just to be frivolous. Can you imagine somebody not feeling shame but feeling pride in the misbehavior of these miscreants? I mean, the crude way of putting it is, you see there, we Jewish guys, we're not all nerds. We're not the kind of guy that can't appreciate a nicely turned ankle. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, by the way, it is interesting that I do feel a different, because it's not correlated with Jewish stereotypes, it is a different issue in
yes.
a funny way.
Yeah, that's it, a
like
really
when Jews
important
are,
point.
When Jews are Bernie Madoff.
Yeah. That's a really important.
Bernie Madoff really resonates with you Jews can't be trusted.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shysters and all that kind of stuff. And that makes me – I get very nervous when I see stuff like that because I think that's reinforcing the way people are going to think about, you know, the idea that Jews are sort of clannish and not to be fully trusted. This is – there's a sense in which I'm I can't say that it – I think if they were – when you know, Hank Greenberg, of course, everybody did. That was fantastic.
Sure.
You know, he was like the Gollum, you know, hitting the ball out of the park. And you know, Jeremy Lin is another example where a lot of Asian Americans are like – Bruce Lee, you know, we're kicking ass. And people really enjoy that. I do think that it cuts – I feel a little bit cut down to size because there's a sense of where it really does hit is there is a sense of Jewish chauvinism. And, you know, you do kind of do Jew counting when people win the Nobel Prize and
do you?
And this kind of stuff. I mean, there's a part of my brain that's kind of aware.
You've counted yourself up to a high number. If that's what you're doing, you've counted yourself up to a high number.
Yeah, and you know, Jewish gangsters, you kind of don't, you know, they're a shanda, you know, that we like
but,
to, you
but,
know.
But some may take pride in it. That was the point I was making earlier.
Yep.
There might be a kind of seamy underside kind of thing. The other thing I want to say is.
By the way, I would say that, by the way, the grossness of Harvey Weinstein and stuff like that, I would take more pride if it was like a swagger. I mean,
no,
somebody
I got
sort
it.
Of a swaggering playboy, you might sort of see, hey, that's kind of cool if there's a George Clooney-like figure but who's Jewish. The stories are so disgusting.
Yeah, I got it.
I mean, I must say part of it. So anyway.
No, ahead. I want to go back to something else that you were saying, which was the distinction between if the collective reputational impact resonated with a pre-existing stereotype about the group, that's one thing, much more serious than if it was simply, you know, it turns out that a lot of the people who are being humiliated for their misdeeds in terms of sexual workplace behavior happened to have been Jewish. And the Jewish embezzlement is not some place we want to go. Okay. And that's made not only is that the case because there's this pre-existing stereotype of Jews as shysters and swindlers, but also because there's overrepresentation of Jews in the financial industry. And if a given percentage of financial industry types are going to be shady, a disproportionate number of them are going to be Jewish. That's just an empirical fact. Likewise, in the hard inner cities of America where poor people live and blacks are overrepresented and drugs are traded on the street and people carry guns, of course there's going to be so-called black crime. There's going to be an overrepresentation of blacks amongst those people, given that there's no representation of blacks in the general social location from which those people are disproportionately drawn. So, I think that's all, but it's a deeper thing, Harold, because that means there's an element of truth, quote unquote. And the people who are promulgating the stereotype will more frequently be able to say, you see there, it's political correctness. You're trying to suppress me from acknowledging the truth, quote unquote, the truth about, whatever the issue might be. So,
and especially, by the way, if you combine that with another Nobel Prize winner, Danny Kahneman, and the things that we know about availability heuristics and representativeness bias, boy, those things are powerful. When there's an African American who is arrested for a gang related homicide, and you see that picture, you know that really is going to hit those dopamine receptors.
I got it.
In a particular way, yeah.
This is the point that beliefs are not rationally formed based on some Bayesian extension of inference from the evidence, that we are to some degree programmed to believe what we want to believe, to believe what makes us feel good. Okay?
Well, and that we have efficient algorithms that are not fully rational or reflective, that work a lot of the time, but that introduce predictable biases that particularly when we make generalizations about groups are especially harmful. That, you know,
well,
we have these scripts that we use that, you know, I'm a 17-year-old African-American kid and Harold Pollack steps on my shoe versus another 17-year-old African-American kid steps on my shoe, I act differently in those two situations.
Yeah, I believe it.
And in part it's being Bayesian, and in part it's just something about the scripts that we have, and those things matter a lot. So I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to move on to another subject. We have a rich agenda here.
We do.
But I wanted to say something about the rationality of collective feelings of pride, shame, guilt, and so on. I remember an essay by Randall Kennedy from a long time ago. It would have been in the 1980s. My Race Problem and Ours, is that what he called it? It was something like that. And in it, he was reflecting on whether he should feel a particular affinity for students who were black relative to other students, or where, you know, and he was it was like in the Atlantic or something like that. It was in a very prominent place, this article. And his view was to be skeptical about claims of group pride, loyalty, and so forth. I remember at the time thinking, because at the time it was a kind of outlier position, I guess it would so be so as well today. I was kind of against him in some way. I mean, I wanted to say it wasn't completely irrational to want to be, for example, married to someone who was also in my race, quote unquote, even though I don't believe in race as some kind of, you know, essential biological thing. My identity had a racial element to it, and likewise, as you say, taking pride in Hank Greenberry hitting the ball over the fence or whatever it might be, or in Paul Samuelson changing the way people do economics every place on the planet. Who wouldn't take pride in that? I take pride in that. It's not irrational, because Paul Samuelson, in the case at hand, didn't come from, quote, as it were, nowhere. He came out of a tradition, he was nurtured by practice, and he had associates and affiliations, and those things were rooted. I think he's from Gary, Indiana, as it happened. Happened to pick this one guy. But, you know, everybody can't tell that story. That's a very particular story. Came from a very particular place. I don't know if the ancestors came from Eastern Europe. Maybe it came from Russia or Ukraine or something like that, or Baltic states or whatever. And they got a story to tell. And, you know, it's a Jewish story, and, you know, one of the many Jewish stories. And why not take pride in that? What else are you going to take pride in if you're not going to take pride in something like that? So yeah. I find that to be completely a rational thing to do. A shame. Now, I can understand the sense of disappointment that my reputation, the collective reputation, has taken a hit, okay? Now, if all someone knows about me is that I belong to this group, and one of my fellow group members has done something very bad, their ex post estimate of the likelihood, if all they know is that I belong to the group, that I, too, will do that bad thing, probably has to go up. It's not going to go down, okay? Yeah. So I can see feeling badly about that. All right. But shame is a different thing. Shame is almost like I have responsibility for it. You know, and I don't know that I should feel that unless I think that the misbehavior has been in its way an expression of something deeply rooted in my group's traditions, histories, and practices, just as much as the ideal behavior that I want to lionize, in the case at hand, Paul Samuelson, reflects the traditions from which he came. If I feel that the acting out reflects something that I know or sense is true about my group, then perhaps I want to feel ashamed for it.
Well, you know, that's a very perceptive way to put it. I think that some of that is going on. You know, I mean, let me give a very not totally personal example, but not totally personally distant example. So, you know, I know Leon Wieseltier casually. I've met him a couple of times. My Wieseltier number is certainly, you know, many, many people. We have many, many common acquaintances in common.
Well, I just want to interject, Harold, that I used to write for the New Republic magazine when he was a literary editor there, and I encountered him on more than one occasion. Go on.
And as I was also, although less of a luminary in the New Republic than you, but I did, I worked, had a wonderful time with Jonathan Cohn as my editor there on health reform. And there's two things that where I really feel a kind of granular shame about about that. I did not know. I knew that he had a reputation of having lots of affairs that I think was known by everyone except for my mom in the United States, but I never knew about the misconduct. Although apparently, that was fairly widely known. And the one thing was, what is it about my tradition that here is this person who's completely steeped in it, one of the most brilliant and erudite people that I've ever, that I can imagine. I mean, really a remarkable intellect. And somehow those really very positive qualities of human insight and erudition coexist with a level of that of baseness over many, many years. Somehow that having the keys to the kingdom of so much in this tradition that I so highly value did not somehow provide protection for him, but also that he was in the world that I knew so well that failed to hold him to account when there was a real impact on surrounding lives. And Harvey Weinstein is a somewhat different story. That's not a world that I'm in any way connected to, but you see where I'm going with that.
No, I do. I want to interject something. I want you to continue talking about this because it's important. I just want to interject something. Yes, the New Republic was a very Jewish world. Weasel Tear was partnering with Martin Peretz. Yeah. When he was the owner of the New Republic in its heyday, in my opinion, in its heyday of the 1980s and 1990s when I was writing for it, but not because I was writing for it. A lot of the people who ended up editing the magazine and so on were very talented young Jewish journalists and social critics whose careers have fanned out all over American culture. I mean, you see them everywhere.
Yeah.
Leon, I mean, I don't know anything about what was going on in those offices in D.C., but, you know, evidently, he was hitting on people and he was exploiting his position and whatnot. You say he's this very brilliant guy. I don't dispute that. He is a very brilliant guy and he writes like with thunder. He has a way of expressing himself that is really quite profound. And, you know, he's all over the place, and I couldn't even begin to catalog all that he's done. I do know that he studied with Isaiah Berlin, and that is not a bad place to start.
Yeah.
I also know he's never written the great big book, though, which has been a criticism. You know, where is the – we expect a book for the ages from this sage, and it hasn't yet come. I also know that he's a fairly intensely committed Zionist, and that sometimes he has allowed that, in my opinion, to color the way in which he's approached some of the important issues of our time.
By the way, can I just interject one thing about that? The reaction, I do – one of the things that concerns me as – and there's going to be many more men. It's obvious that we're in a period where – people's names will be, you know, there's the shitty media men's list that's sort of going around, that a spreadsheet of allegations. There's a lot of – we're going to hear more names of people. I do think people's reaction is very colored by people's ideological and political relationships with that person. So and the relationship between – yeah, so a lot of people who always disagreed with Weasel Tear politically, of course, they're like, aha, you know, this is I always knew, that he had this deep character flaw. And there is a sense in which there's a relationship between political values and personal behavior and character. It's complicated. It's much more congenial for us to identify like when I look at Fox News, which has had a million, the whole place seems to be filled with sexual harassment and non-disclosure agreements and stuff. For me, I'm like, well, no kidding. You know, here's a bunch of people I despise on the basis of the propaganda that they put out every day and the sexism of what's on the TV. So I'm ready to believe, of course, everything that I hear about Roger Ailes or Bill O'Reilly is very congenial. And I think we all have to be a little bit careful that there's a sense of Schadenfreude and of bloodlust when those two things come together one of the reminders is people that we really admire, whose politics we largely share, are quite capable of the same kinds of behavior that we easily see as horrible when other people engage it. I think there's a real lesson there. It's not all going to be, you know, the Roger Ailes of the world. It's going to be, you know, Bill Clinton is a good example. You know, he, so and so on. So you see where I'm.
No, I do see. I see the point about it's really the Kahneman point, the kind of psychology behavioral point in a way. If it's a bad news about somebody that we don't like for other reasons, we're much more happy to receive it and willing to believe it.
Yeah.
I'm very. You say there's going to be a lot more cases, and obviously, I think that's a valid prediction. I wouldn't bet against that.
Yeah.
This thing of Mark Halperin at MSNBC, for example, and whatnot, and these things can have happened 10 or 15 years ago, and women may have suppressed not saying about it, but now they will feel licensed to, and they will reinforce each other as they do so if the offender has multiple victims involved and so forth. The word that I wrote down on my pad here is witch hunt, Harold. And I what I want to say is, I'm a little bit uneasy about it all, and I'm uneasy saying that I'm uneasy about it. And you know why? One of the reasons I'm uneasy saying I'm uneasy about it is because that makes me a target. And if right now you're thinking, if you didn't do anything wrong, you don't have anything to be afraid of, that's exactly the problem. Okay?
So say more about
No, what I'm saying is, I'm saying witch hunt, and I'm saying this is, I could try to give a very precise social scientific definition, but I haven't actually done the research yet, so this is going to be a little bit crude, but the idea is it's a kind of collective mania. It's something that gets out of hand, okay? It's a kind of moral panic would be a concept that I know has been used in other settings in writing about American history and things like that, a kind of collective hysteria. Now,
what is it? Well, so far we have had it's either there's elements of collective hysteria, maybe we can talk about whether that's there, but there's also elements that this is a pervasive problem, that is a pervasive real problem.
Let me get to that. You cut me off.
And there's collective anger about it because now it's being brought up.
Yeah, okay. And I agree, okay? But I hadn't yet given my analysis, which was to say this behavior about power and sex with discretion, they're hierarchical organizations. Okay, people are trying to move up. Sex is a reality. It knows no political boundary. It knows no ideological territory. It's not something that you're going to see in one industry but not in the other industry or on one side. It shouldn't be used to make generic conclusions. You know, it's at Fox News and therefore the whatever, because, you know, it could be at MSNBC. I'm not saying it is or it isn't, but it certainly could be. What would keep it from being there? Harvey Weinstein has got to be the, quote, tip of the iceberg, as the cliche would go, and so on and so forth.
Hold on, I just want to make this point. Yeah, go ahead.
15 years goes by, someone has done something. They've done something, okay? I didn't say they didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
I am not defending it. Their career is destroyed, okay? They can't get work because of something they did 15 years ago. I guess what? If they had robbed a bodega with a pistol, they'd be able to get work if it was 15 or 20 years ago. If they had been high on an illicit substance or patronized a prostitute, they'd be able to get work because we would say it was 15 years ago or 20 years ago. Okay? The imputation of intrinsic unfitness because of these deeds and the characterization of people as predators. Okay? There's a slippery slope here. We need to be careful about this. A lot of people can get hurt and the justness of it is unclear. And you're observing correctly that men have power, that they use that power to coerce sex from women, that they do it in the workplace to the disadvantage of women and in contravention of the law being true, your observation of that being true, does not obviate the concern that I'm raising. This thing needs to be kept within bounds. I don't like the idea of allegations coming out from 15 or 20 years ago destroying people's careers. I want a much more granular mechanism of assessing this than simply the rush to judgment that comes when the media decide to make a frenzy out of the fact that some prominent person has been exposed, in this case, Leon Wieseltier. That magazine went down because of this. Is that an appropriate? Maybe so. Maybe so. But did the process through which that happened vet the facts in a way that would make that a rational assessment, or was that simply a rush to judgment?
Well, by the way, let me make one detour point and then engage the point that you just made.
Okay, thank you for giving me so much time. I appreciate it.
No, I think you're raising a very legitimate point, and it's a point because the cases that are coming out now are so extreme and obvious, and because they involve institutional malfeasance beyond an individual person in various ways, we might lose sight of the need for due process and judiciousness as the ball gets – what makes this a slippery slope is the cases that have come out so far are so disgusting and have so many elements that are horrible that's how you get moving on.
Sure.
They create momentum for something that might be more troubling in a variety of ways. But one thing that Rebecca Traister and Ezra Klein noted about – some of the particular people that have been involved in sexual misconduct and misogyny and so on, when I think about some of those people are very important people who shape public debate. And when you think about – so Mark Halperin played a critical role in framing the 2016 and 2008 election.
I know.
And you look at some of the quotes that he had, some of the quotes that Wieseltier had about Hillary Clinton. And the way that she was – that was really filled with gender stereotypes and so on. There is something about – these are powerful people who were in a position to – it makes me – when I go back and read the things that – what they were saying on TV about – you know, Mark Halperin, for example, saying that the sexual – that the allegations against Donald Trump about sexual misconduct are just way overblown and – so I
can't agree with you.
With a bad taste.
I think you're doing right now exactly what you warned against doing, which was allowing political preference to induce a Schadenfreude at the misdeeds exposed about someone else. And in a way, I think that's what you're doing. Yes, about Mark Halperin. He was, as between Mark Halperin and John Heilman, who were the team that wrote Game Change, that yeah. important book about the 2008 campaign, and who also had this the circus at Showtime, this very high production value docudrama, you could almost call it, coverage of the 2016 campaign. And it's very brilliant work. I mean, I think you have to acknowledge it's quite important political journalism. Let me just say this. Mark Halperin is the guy who would say, yeah, but, okay? When everybody was saying Trump is an asshole, he's the guy who would say, yeah, but. He's a guy who called Obama a dick on MSNBC. He said the president is acting like a dick, and they suspended him for that. Okay? He would be the guy who would voice whatever would be the conservative narrative line in a reportage that was coming out of this collaboration. And Heilman would be the guy who was more dependably and reliably, whatever. I know there have got to be a lot of people out there who hate Mark Halperin. Now, you just said that his characterization of Hillary Clinton was sexist. And I'm not disputing that. I don't want to be misunderstood here. I don't know whether it's true or not. I'm not endorsing it. I'm not disputing it. You've linked it to the fact that he has now become accused of having behaved sexually in a wrong way. And therefore, you've implied that there's a connection between the two. There's a connection between his coverage of Hillary Clinton and the fact that he misbehaved sexually in the workplace. I think that's a real stretch. I think that is the camel's nose under the tent of witch huntery.
Well,
that's where it begins.
It depends on what evidence there is. I agree that one should have to give evidence for that connection. But you know, and also going to the New Republic, one of the things that was striking about the allegations about Wieseltier, it wasn't just that he was hitting on all these women. It was the way that he discussed women in meetings, the very tiny number of women writers whose books were reviewed or who were reviewers in the back of the book, and the way that mean, this is a person whose mentality towards women was reflected in many dimensions. And when we it's a legitimate thing to ask. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right. Never mind. I withdraw. And you know why I'm withdrawing? I'm withdrawing and I'm moving us on to the next topic in this conversation.
Oh, okay. Let's do that.
Because I'm afraid. No, I want to say this. I'm afraid. I want everybody in the world to know I'm scared to discuss this issue in public. Okay. Because I do not want to become a target. Okay.
Okay.
So y'all have got me cowed. I'm gonna just nod in affirmation of the zeitgeist. Sorry, Harold, but I needed to say that for my
own
dignity.
Okay.
Next thing is the margins. It's the political margins of intensity and extensivity. And what are we saying about that? How did it come up in our bi conversation?
So I was watching your conversation with Mark Lilla.
Mark Lilla.
And noting the critique that Professor Lilla offers, which is that basically Democrats we're getting killed around the country, in state and local governments all over, and essentially claiming that Democrats have become too focused on identity politics and issues that are critical to the Democratic base, but that alienate people that are, say, not involved, who are not really animated by debates about intersectionality or Black Lives Matter or variety of things that in campus politics are central. And I think we had a somewhat humorous email exchange where I noted that you have two Ivy League professors obsessed with campus politics who are not political activists, who are telling the political activists that they're too need to be out in the south side of Chicago organizing. But I think that there's an interesting – I mean, there are people who mobilize at the intensive margin to try to mobilize your base, and there are people who are trying to mobilize at the extensive margin to try to recruit people who are marginal voters. And both activities – it's very hard – are critical, and it's very hard to do both of those things well at the same time. And in some ways, I think Hillary Clinton really got caught in a vice in 2016 where she had to hold her base together. So she defeated Bernie Sanders by mobilizing her African-American base. And by doing that, in some ways, she really racialized the election and made it harder for her to mobilize at the extensive margin. And a lot of what I've been doing in my own advocacy is trying very hard to balance that. I must say I found that Medicaid and health reform have been fantastic issues for liberals to mobilize on because the things that we do to mobilize our own base don't alienate other people. You know, on Medicaid, I made Facebook ads during the repeal and replace fight, and I reached about 400,000 people. It was not – I'm not a major super PAC, but it was – you know, I got 10,000 people to call senators.
Wow.
So, you know,
if each one gets 10,000, I think we get to 100 million pretty quickly.
That's right. And I really tried hard to say, how am I going to get somebody in West Virginia excited enough to call Senator Capito, and to move her to vote against, the repeal effort. And it's a tricky thing because you cannot, because, you know, I'm reaching people that are culturally, politically in West Virginia, they're not core Democratic voters necessarily. On the other hand, they're core enough that they're active. And it's been a really interesting exercise. But that's the problem on the table.
So let me say something. I want to say something about the Democrats' intensive and extensive, and I want to say something about me and Mark Lilla being eggheads at the Ivy League and you doing something on the ground. Let me take the latter first. So, Mark Lilla, the book Once and Future Liberal, and he's against identity politics, and he says it's Reaganism for lefties, which is to say it's a kind of opting out of citizenship and solidarity across lines in order to emphasize, in this case, identity rather than your own personal pocketbook bottom line, which would be Reaganism for righties. Mm-hmm. And he's pilloried across many platforms on the liberal Twitter sphere, whatever, whatever. He's basically called a white supremacist for suggesting that trying to go after the identity interest of this or that group, race or ethnicity or sexuality or whatever, at the expense of alienating the sort of on-the-fence Midwesterner who might have made Michigan or Pennsylvania or Ohio go a different way, is a kind of electoral dead end that he's saying. And they're pillorying him and saying that he doesn't, you know, as it were, care enough about the deep moral issues and so forth. And the reason that, and this is campus politics, okay, this is all in the bubble of the kind of high intellectuality, and it's not knocking on anybody's door or making a telephone call. Yeah. But the reason that it's important is, I think, not more important, I'm not saying that, or not a substitute for, but the reason that it's important is because the idea makers and shakers come out of these venues. And the fact that the very raising of this point leads to a kind of vitriolic reaction in some quarters is telling us something about our intellectual culture that I do think at the end of the day accounts for why, let's say, Hillary Clinton has the mothers of the movement on the stage at the Democratic National Convention. I know I've mentioned this before, and people don't think I have a thing about that. I just think it's a good example. Mothers of the movement are the mothers of black kids who were killed by police officers.
Not all the mothers of the movement, by the way. There are Trayvon Martin's mother, I think, was one of the
prominent
people.
Okay.
So there's some good. Other
of cases that have come to prominence of the mistreatment of African Americans at the hands of authority or in whatever. Mm-hmm. And because it's Black Lives Matter, because there's a movement out there called Black Lives Matter. Okay, there's a context. It's called Ferguson, Missouri, 2014. Now this is not coming out of nowhere. Okay. So what's this about? This is about mobilizing my base. This is about people getting them to turn out in Charlotte, North Carolina, and getting them to turn out in Philadelphia and Milwaukee and things like that. So that's a bet. That's a bet. That's a play. Okay, now the question is it a good play or is it a bad play? I think it's a bad play. I think the ambiguity of some of these cases, Michael Brown? The ambiguity of some of these cases, where the fact that officers haven't been indicted might simply be an expression of justice. And counting on the fact that people in suburban St. Louis and in suburban Philadelphia will look at this and buy the narrative being oppression of black bodies by racist authority, white supremacy, and so forth, and not buy a counter narrative such as if some of you all had been better mothers, your children would have been out there engaged in behavior that led to their demise. Now, I said that is a very, very hard thing to say. Believe me, I'm not the first person to think that thought. Now, you talk about intensive and extensive margin, and I'm trying to understand the underpinnings of that decision. Because that decision was made by people, campaign operatives, organizers, and the such. And those people are influenced by ideas. And those ideas are produced on university campuses, and they're promulgated on op-ed pages. And that's exactly what Mark Lilla is talking about.
But one of the ironies of this is to the extent that the Black Lives Matter critique of American society is correct, it underscores the tactical dilemma that Black Lives Matter itself poses to the Democratic Party and to political candidates who wish to advance the interests of the African American community. If we say, you know, white supremacy and anxiety about the growing multiracial, multicultural nature of America, that is truly a powerful force in American politics. And we elected a racist person to be president of the United States who challenged the birth certificate of Barack Obama. I mean, if you say that is, there's a powerful political current in America that is capable of being activated that is, that is a white race identity politics. Let's say the election of Donald Trump shows there's a lot more to that than we might have hoped. Okay, so how do we respond to that as political actors? Because some of the people, you know, if you look at the Democratic primary voters, if you look at, you know, various measures of white race identity and so on, that completely predicts who voted for Trump in the primaries. It's astonishing the extent these scales of white identity, like if whites who rate their own racial identity as being unimportant, like 4% of them voted for Trump. Among those who rate as very important, like 81% voted for Trump. in the Republican primary voters. So that's a reality.
Which proves exactly
so,
what? I'm sorry, what is the reality? Because well, I'm not buying it.
I think the reality is that there is a group with that is of strategic importance within the Republican Party and in parts of the country who I would not use the word racist, but I would say people have attitudes where when they see Black Lives Matter protesters and so on, it frames their
– Let me
it
respond.
Has political impact on them.
Let me respond.
So let me just finish one second. So let's just take for the – if you believe what I'm saying is right and you may reject it,
how do
Democratic candidates respond? So it is – one of the great things about an issue like Medicaid and health reform is that some of those marginal voters – have a disabled kid. They believe in social insurance, even though the racial attitudes may not be what Harold Pollack wants them to be.
Okay.
It's very advantageous to be able to campaign on the basis of universal values around universal health care that doesn't hit those dopamine receptors. And that's a real tactical challenge for Democrats.
Let me respond, Harold.
Go ahead.
I understand the assertion of essential racism in this part of the electorate and the observation that it creates very difficult obstacles for Democrats who are trying to create these coalitions. Mm-hmm. I want to respond.
Okay.
I don't agree with the claim. I don't know what you can infer from the fact that there's a correlation between some index of white identity thing and Trump voting. I'm not sure that you can infer anything as robust as what you want to say on the basis of that. We could come back to that. Black Lives Matter is not some generic expression of black aspiration in America to which a racist, if he opposes it, would object. It's a radical movement. Have you read their manifesto? Do you know what they stand for and what they call for? Let me just say this. These people are not in the mainstream of American politics. If you go and look at their list of demands, it's a laundry list of the far left's ideological positions on a lot of issues that don't have anything to do with police.
By the way, I don't think there's any particular they there. I think one of the challenges
is
that
Black Lives Matter. Okay, fine. So then we can quibble about whether or not the subject behind the point that I'm making, which is how the rhetoric and the identity of Black Lives Matter affects voters who happen not to be Democrats sometimes. We can quibble about whether or not there's a real thing called Black Lives Matter. I don't care. The point I'm trying to make is that the narrative is radical. And opposition to it is not an expression of racism. Let me just be more clear about that. They don't speak for me, Harold. And they don't speak for black people. They don't represent the aspirations of black people. They are a particular historic phenomenon. It's rooted in the African-American experience, but it is not characteristic of it. They don't like the churches, for example. Not a single one of them. They don't speak for me, and they don't speak for my people. And therefore, opposition to their vitriol, to their raining down projectiles on police officers, to their equivocation on basic expressions of fealty to the country and our collective enterprise here, when people react against that, no, they don't have a get out of jail free card because they're black.
But
they have to live with the political consequences of what they do. I do not accept that the fact that Western Pennsylvanians, Southern Ohioans, out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin's, and a majority of the voters in the state of Michigan affirm Trump tells me that there's some intrinsic white supremacist strain of contempt and hatred in this country. It does not, okay? And unless Democrats reckon with the fact that not everybody has to like affirmative action, that not everybody has to line up and genuflect, as I just did on the gender issue, when a black person stands up in Congress and goes through some kind of act, they can react to it the way mature voters react, which is, I have contempt for Colin Kaepernick taking a knee while my national anthem is playing. They can have contempt for that without being racist, I'm saying. Thank you for allowing me to express myself. Thank you.
Well, I think there's a couple of things I would say to that. One is I do think the word they, I mean, there are NFL players taking a knee in the national anthem, there are people who are involved in violent protest. There are people who are saying, I'm really concerned about police misconduct. Okay. There's a wide range of people. One of the challenges with any sprawling grassroots movement is it's not exactly clear who should be held accountable for what. I do think that as a frame, if I am a racist politician, the idea of young, angry black activists versus police is a godsend for me. And it is – that's like the worst possible – tactical framing for the Democratic Party in much of the country. And black activists,
can I just say this? I'm sorry to interrupt. The black activists do not have to be antagonistic to the police. They could be working with the police on behalf of saving black lives. They've made an ideological choice. Just as using the playing of the national anthem as the occasion to express your concerns about social organization in the United States is a choice. It's a choice. They're putting their fingers in people's eye, and they know that they're doing it.
Well, they don't get a get-out-of-jail-free card.
People get to feel the way about that they feel, and they're doing so doesn't make them racist. And the fact that a very tiny fraction of this society who sit in university campuses think so is politically irrelevant.
Well, let me say, I know some of these people in Chicago. And in fact, some of the people that are involved in these demonstrations are also people that are involved in violence prevention efforts and have relationships with police. And they do have legitimacy on the south side of Chicago because of the things that are happening in the Chicago Police Department. And it is, I think it's a strategic choice to, you know, how they do that. And, I think that how we – I don't – Colin Kaepernick is one person. I think a lot of the people who are kneeling during the national anthem are trying to send – the way that they describe what they are doing themselves is that we are in a civil and dignified way expressing concern about this issue. And but I think the structural challenge is how do you – so there are large segments of the African American community and of base Democratic activists who have a set of – who are really concerned about this issue, and you want to honor that and advance that policy position, and you also want to do that in a way that is effective to reach out to other people. And I think that moving forward – I must say I think Mark Lilla's book, by the way, was written – a lot of it was written right after the election, I'm assuming that the New York Times op-ed that he wrote – I think what's really interesting is that right now activism is much more effective than – I'm much more optimistic than Mark Lilla is from what I see from Indivisible and groups like that. And the way that – I mean, we defeated Republicans on the ACA repeal. We are hammering President Trump on a lot of fronts politically, and Republicans are very nervous heading into the 2018 election because we are finding issues that – base Democratic voters are passionate about, but that not only base Democratic voters are excited about. What I found with the Medicaid advocacy was there's just a ton of people who are – many of them may have voted for Trump who are saying, you know, I actually do not want to screw all of these people who are sick and that when it comes down to it, I think that the lesson that Lilla is trying to teach – actually, a lot of Democratic activists get that, and what they're actually doing on the ground is trying to come up with universal messages and do it in a way that does not alienate any core group of Democratic voters. You know, you don't go to Western Pennsylvania and say, I'm really going to hit the transgender issue as my key organizing principle, you know, to get people out to defeat this Republican. But you'd also say, but you know what? We actually – here's where we stand on that transgender issue. And it turns out very often that that you can reach people and you can strike that balance. You can say, you know, we're not gonna really make the bathroom issue our core issue, but you know what? It actually is pretty fucked up that Republicans are trying to, you know, tell transgender people which bathroom to use and do it in a way that honors, you know, the of that part of your coalition. It's not easy to do. One of the problems BLM has is a lot of their most passionate people are just young people who are not experienced political actors. And so, you know, people like me have to get out and do our thing if we don't like the way they're doing their thing.
Have you read the coalition's – you've read the coalition's list of demands?
I just don't think that they represent – I don't think that when I – there's a group of people who have a bunch of beliefs that I don't particularly care for. I've seen some of the things that they have, like they get involved in the Palestinian issue and all this other stuff. Fine. Those are particular people.
You read We Were 8 Years in Power?
I have read the individual essays in that book. Yes, I have.
Do you follow Black Twitter?
Actually, Black Twitter follows me.
I like the way you said that, Harold. I like the way you said that. My impression is that the boundary blurring, basically decent, progressive organizing spirit that one might find on the streets of a city like Chicago and with which you would affiliate doesn't really, and which is real, and I'm not denying that it exists, doesn't change the fact that the drumbeat and the driving kind of ideology, you say these football players are really trying to do, yeah, of course they are. I mean, most of them, you know, they're not political theorists and they're not social critics and they're, you know, they have sentiments and affiliations and identifications and I would assume that their meanings are not nefarious. The sense that this moment, I mean, I just think it's very wrong. I think it's deeply wrong. And I'm going to say something that we don't have time for me to justify, and maybe we have another conversation. But I think what's happening here is that it's an exhaustion of the progressive hope. You say you're hopeful about dealing with the problem of African-American marginality in the society, subordination, disadvantage, and whatnot. That the white supremacist positions and impediments have basically collapsed, and yet they're, you know, 2/3 to 3/4 of black kids are born to women who aren't married, and the sociologists say it doesn't matter, the ones in places like University of Chicago, but it does matter. Okay, and common sense people know it matters, and you can talk sociology until the cows come home about crime and incarceration and whatnot, but basically people are not buying it. They're not buying the new Jim Crow. They're not buying it. They're saying you're reaping what you've sown. Failure across the board. In education, failure, okay? A failure to seize opportunity. And the narrative, therefore, has had to shift, and it shifted onto this ground. It is shaky ground. It's a bluff. That's my argument. My argument is that at the end of the day, you're holding a pair of deuces, okay? It's going to collapse. And what we're going to have is not effective responses to these problems. I'm going to say this here. It's going to piss you off. Trump said he wanted to fix the inner city. Now, F-U-C-K Trump. This is not about Trump. I want to fix the inner cities. Okay? I want to see asserted federal action to do it. If the guy who won an election saying every time he gave a speech that he was going to do something is in the office, I want to find a way to get it done. Okay? Now, he can be an A-S-S-H-O-L-E. Let's say that's what he is. That does not exhaust the discussion. The resistance is a dead end. You either elect somebody else or you work with this guy to get something done, especially if you live in the inner cities.
Now, see, I think that it is very – I think, by the way, what we're reaching a dead end to, in some ways, is the way that our political institutions are increasingly dysfunctional. I think one of the most important things we need to do – for the future of the country is to show Republicans that the election of this comprehensively unworthy, despicable figure was a disaster that they can never repeat, and that what Democrats have to do is implacably resist not just President Trump, but seize offices at the state and local level, the House and Senate, and show that that the kind of politics that he won an election with in 2016 does not work. He's trying to do a proof of concept where I have a coalition that is entirely non-Hispanic white people that, you know, I was thinking of the disaster, for example, in Puerto Rico, where he just doesn't care about it. He's not deploying resources on it. And it's not his base, you know, and there's this sense in a way that's different from, say, George W. Bush. It's very, very important that we implacably oppose that, not just by opposing President Trump, but by defeating the effort to repeal health reform, on and on. And I feel it's fine. I'm an incremental liberal in terms of my policy views, but my views about partisanship have become more and more radicalized in terms of, you know, we tried to, you know, President Obama had a vision that was, that sought to reach across the aisle. There are no blue states. There are no red states. You know, that's, we have to understand, who we're confronted with, and that President Trump is, reflects the, there's a very important group within the Republican Party that he represents, and they have to be defeated. I would, if there's areas where he can be worked with, say in the opioid epidemic, you know, there are times when one has to work with him. I certainly work with Republican policymakers around the country around these issues. But my goal was to drive him from office by every legitimate means that that I can find. And I'm much less offended by the guys kneeling in the national anthem than I am by every day seeing that guy in the Oval Office. And, you know, they are if I have to choose between them, I prefer the guys kneeling, but I want to help them do it in a way that's politically effective.
Okay, Harold, as you said earlier, still waters run deep, and there's obviously a lot going on with you. I'm going to let you have the last word. Harold, I have ranted more than my quota of ranting in this particular conversation. Thanks for putting up with me.
And I ranted at the end there.
More power to you. I'm not necessarily endorsing anything you said, but I'm not arguing with it either.
Well, bless you, my friend. I always enjoy talking to you.
Me too. Take care. I'm going to stop the tape. We are back for an addendum. This is like the Bill Maher show where they have the after-hour thing online where the guests sit around and talk. Harold and I were talking. He has something to say. I'm not in this. This is just Harold.
Well, yeah, we were just talking about Hillary Clinton, and I was lamenting how
Excuse me for interrupting, Harold. I had that early tape glitch again where my machine has to run for 15 to 20 seconds, so I have to start over again. We are here at the after hours of the Glenn Show at blogheads.tv. This is Glenn Lowry with Harold Pollack. Just like on one of these late night talk shows where they have the show and then they have a thing online where the guests sit around, we were talking. Harold has something more that he wants to add, an addendum to the previous conversation. Take it away, Harold.
We were talking after the tape was shut off about how I was feeling so sad and lamenting how Hillary Clinton just completely cleaned Trump's clock during the debates, and partly for gender reasons, people were annoyed by that performance in some ways, but also that Democratic activists are really, really angry because we elected a racist, misogynist president who's just so unworthy of the office, and they're right to be angry, and their WTF reaction. Like, what the hell is wrong with our country that this happened? Has to be honored. And it's not always done in a pretty way. That anger is not always expressed in the way that is most tactically useful. But it's very genuine, and it's very real, and it's very legitimate. And I think that that we have to respect that, because I feel that anger myself. And I know a lot of my fellow liberals feel that anger. And I'm uncomfortable with the way that it's not always expressed with the decorum that I like to communicate with, but man, it was provoked, and we have to somehow find a way to mobilize that energy into positive and effective political action to advance humane values in the country, because that's where we are. So I just wanted to say that.
Okay, you got a chance to say it. I could try to rebut whatever, but I guess I'll only say this about Hillary Clinton and sexism and your observation that she was better in the debates than she got credit for, because people couldn't quite get with a woman being that kind of effective person vis-a-vis a man. I wanted to say, no arguing. And then I wanted to say, such is the terrain upon which we operate. It's lamentable, but it is indeed the fact. And one can either spend one's time lamenting that fact or spend one's time trying to figure out how to get over the hump that's in front of you. And as lamentable as that hump is, there it is. Okay, so it may be that lecturing people about, there's no such good thing as a good Trump voter. If you voted for Trump, you're intrinsically a racist person or a misogynist or something. That may not be a very effective way of trying to get over the hump. That was the thing I was going to say. And about the anger, sure, people feel that way, but Mark Lula would say, if you don't win an election, it's not going to make any difference at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, that is true. Well, that's why I must say I take great heart in some of our political victories we've had recently, and we've got to find a way to combine movement politics and Democratic Party institutional politics in a way that works, that we can feel good about. And, I'm actually pretty optimistic we're going to do that, and I'm going to spend a lot of time and effort trying to make that happen. And
2018
I'm going to
is a big
you.
Year. We have a limit. We have a 5-minute limit on the addendum, and we are at 3 minutes and 52 seconds, so we have enough time for me to say this. Bob Corker, Jeff Flake. Not that we're going to start a conversation, just I'm going to put on the table the idea that threats of primary challenges probably forced these very able men out of the Senate. Those are some elections that Democrats need to win if indeed Steve Bannon gets his way and you get far-right types like this guy Roy Moore in Alabama, who will likely win down there if you ask me, but that's Alabama. If you get far-right types like that coming in to run on the Republican side in these Senate seats, so y'all need to win those elections. Am I a Democrat? I don't know. But those elections need to be won. Otherwise, it's all just smoke. And it's not going to make any difference.
Well, I'm going to be asking my friend Glenn Lowry how many phone calls he's made and what he's doing as a to help make a more humane society. And
Mark Kleiman, and LaJuan Lowry will be asking exactly that question.
I have a new ally inside the House.
Oh man, it's tough. You do.
That's her photo with her
daughter right there. Can you all see
that? Oh, that's a great picture. And I'm going to mobilize her efforts to maximum effect.
So, 5 minutes and 17 seconds. Hey, I'll see you later, man.
Bye-bye.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.